Good to see you today as we gather together for worship. Hope you had a good week. They go by quickly, and last week, especially since we've had all four meteorological seasons in one week, seems like a long time ago. Last Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday, did you get a chance to catch any of the game? To watch some, I hope. I enjoyed some of the game. I had a plan I was going to put in place, going to have a Super Bowl party as a family. Girls had planned some special foods, and so we were going to get these foods together and enjoy the first half of the game, eat a little bit toward halftime, shut things off for a little bit, appropriately so, and then I was going to work a little. I needed to get some things done, so I was going to work some, then come back toward the end of the game and catch just maybe the last couple minutes and see how things went. So it worked out really. My plan was just right. But it was kind of interesting. I got done watching the first half of the game. We ate some and started toward halftime, and I realized I am really tired. And it had been a long Sunday. We had two worship gatherings last week, and I preached, and so sometimes that wears on me a little bit. And so it's just, but I seemed more tired. And sometimes you sit down to watch a game or something, and you're with people, there's a bit of pump to it, some energy. Okay, I'm enjoying this, and I had some soda and I had coffee, so I was thinking, why am I so tired? Well, I went to get some work, and I was just kind of trudging through, and need to do some, okay, wrap that up, come back to the game. And I sat down, I was a little more refreshed, and I sat down, I just got tired again. And it's then that I realized what was going on. It's when I sat down and I grabbed the remote control again. And I had this feeling, as I watched the last couple minutes of the game, I had this feeling that I've had at times when I'm driving in heavy traffic at higher speeds, where all my faculties are watching what's going on around me, lest I make a mistake and it be costly. Holding that remote control and waiting for the commercial to come up and having all faculties on the television, because if it's a good commercial, you really want to see it. Because it would be funny. This is some of the best entertainment of the year, but it happens in 30-second blocks. But it's also some of the most disastrous. And you have 1 second to get the channel changed before indecencies flooding your home. I felt like during the Super Bowl, I was driving down the highway of depravity at times, trying not to have a wreck. It was wearing me out. I don't know what I'm going to do next year, but I recognize what was going on. It wasn't so much preaching, the longer day. It was that there's danger coming in. I don't want to see that. I maybe want to see this, but in 1 second, this funny commercial could turn south, and I have to be aware of it. And this is our culture. Just Friday morning, driving here, listening to local news radio. And local AM news radio, and the conversation for most of the drive was on these issues of immorality in our culture and visual images that are just everywhere, and what these images signal to the next generation. And so they had a text line open. They were reading various texts, and the couple of anchors, one was that our culture has gone too far, and this is sending the wrong message. One was, well, this is just the way it is. And so I listened to that in the morning. In the evening, watching just local, non-cable, local news, and one of the stories was on this very same issue, the immorality in our culture and various movies and outlets and all of this and how we respond to it and how people are responding. This is just one day, morning and evening, and that's our culture. Spurgeon has this devotional called Morning and Evening. Morning and evening in America is depravity. It's everywhere, everywhere you go. You don't have to spend hardly any time on a media outlet where this kind of stuff is coming at us. And this is important for the church to think about. The gathered church in meetings like this and others, because marriage matters. Because marriages display the gospel, and a part of marriage is sexuality that the culture has perverted. And it's important for the church, as we are gathered, to think clearly, to think biblically about this issue, to guard ourselves, to be equipped so that we don't react wrongly to the culture. The kind of sexuality that's shown and the perversity, it's because it's so blatant, because it's everywhere, and because we as believers are sensitive to this and we recognize the sanctity of sexuality, because so much of what we see is unholy, it's easy, however, for us to begin to think of sexuality itself as unholy. I know many young men who are just recently married, and I had the same struggle, going from a single man, unmarried, multiple times a day, quoting to myself 1 Corinthians 6, "Flee immorality. Every other sin that a man commits is outside his body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. Don't you know that your body was bought for a price? Glorify God." Moving on down through the passage. Multiple times a day to marriage, where within marriage, sexuality is a part of marriage. And now it's not wrong. And it took an extended period of time for me to process this. We live in a culture where sexuality is a perversion, is so much around us that as believers, it's easy to just think of sexuality itself as sin. The problem there begins that it sets in motion a string of events that ultimately weakens marriage. Because God has created sexuality within a heterosexual marriage to be perhaps the most bonding kind of event, the most uniting kind of event in a marriage. It's the one activity that is exclusive to only husband and wife. Husband and wife can eat with several individuals and work with several individuals, social events, church activities, but sexuality is completely exclusive and private, and it's those kind of, in any relationship, the exclusive, private things that actually unite people most specifically. And that's what sexuality does. So if you're asking, why am I talking about this week and next, what's in light of Valentine's Day? It's in light of the perversion of the culture, and I want us to react rightly, because if we don't, it sets in motion a whole pattern of thought and activity that ultimately weakens marriage. And if marriage is weakened, our witness in the world is weakened. I heard Russell Moore speak about a year ago, president of the Ethics Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. He talked about marriages and marriages in churches. And he said, you know, I'm talking here about marriages and churches, and some people who are singles will sometimes think that, well, this isn't important to me, it doesn't matter. Why are they just talking about marriage? And he said, here's why this is important. If you're single and you're a member of a church, the literature that your church sends out, whether it be in the bulletin or a little rack in the back of the church that has information about what your church believes and all of this, or you're sending it out in some way or on a website or something, as a single person, as a believer, you would just come unglued if your church began to promote Islam, or if your church began to promote humanism or something like that in its literature. Well, the primary tracts a church sends out are its marriages. Not just its literature, it's what husband and wife look like, and husbands loving wives as Christ loved the church, and wives submitting to husbands as to the Lord. And it's our marriages that are actually tracks that go out into a city, and they operate in the workplace and in the community. And as a single, you should be concerned about what your church is saying about Christ. And that's my logic here. I'm concerned about the end result, the gospel, and what it looks like in the world through marriages. And so I'm concerned about marriage as a pastor. I'm concerned about the marriages of our church, and I'm concerned about the marriages of our church in this culture, and this culture is extremely perverted. So I want to set our thinking, hopefully, about the glory of God and sexuality, its sanctity, and the need to guard it for the sake of the gospel through our marriages in the world. So, turn with me to Song of Songs. Talked with someone last week, they'd noticed that we're going to be looking at Song of Songs, and they'd never heard that preached before. Well, there's a reason, right? If you've read it, there's a reason. And I'm not going to preach every verse. So parents, you can relax. But let me start with just this, and I'll mention it again before we're done. I have a Bible reading assignment I'd like to give. Did this in November, if memory serves, around Thanksgiving, challenged us to read John 1, 1 through 17, have a Gospel of John party. And I talked with a few families who did this, and I'm glad that you responded and did. We did as a family, read all of John 1 through 17. Had snack. It was a great time. It was so fun to do that together. All right, picking up that same idea, here's what I want. Just husbands and wives, I do want you to read Song of Songs sometime this week, just the two of you in private. Just the two of you to read it aloud together and just hear the language of romantic love and the glory of God in this, the joy that's here, the unity, the strength of marriage that comes. This is what I want for you, husbands and wives. Well, let me talk about what I want to do in our time this morning and a bit of next week as well. I want to set out just the literary framework that I think is best, makes the best sense of Song of Songs. Now, there are a lot of literary theories here. Is it just these snippets of thought that Solomon writes, or is there a narrative going on here in some way, and how do we know? I think there's a bit of a narrative, and I want to set that out here for chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 5 and verse 1. So, I mean, it's just really the first four chapters of the book. And I want to set out sort of the narrative that's here. And you can take some notes on that, but I'm not going to be specific in reading through the text. I'm just going to set it out there. But you can use this framework later on in reading yourself this week and with your spouse. So I'm going to set out that framework, and then I'm going to give seven principles that come generally from these chapters. So the framework is for you to study more this week and follow as you read. See if you can notice the narrative flow of Song of Songs. But then I want to think with you right now about these seven principles, and we will refer to specific spots in Song of Songs here and think about it together. First, though, just the idea that there is a literary framework. John Balkin has taught at Gordon Conwell Seminary in his commentary on Song of Songs, writes this: some think that the book is made up of random collection of love songs, originally independent and then just strung together, perhaps by an editor. This is unlikely, he says, and I agree. There seems to be a genuine sequence in the book. And I want to set that out here for you, this genuine sequence. Here it is, if you're taking notes. This is also available on scripturestoryline.com for you, about the same notes that I've presented there I want to present here in terms of the literary structure. Chapter 1, 1 through about 2, 7, I think has one way to interpret it, and there are a number of outlines that folks have made on the Song of Songs and its literary framework, but this is the one that I think works best. 1:1-2:7, here it is. It's anticipation. If you're wanting just a word or two, anticipation of the wedding night. Anticipation of the first romantic encounter, perhaps. 1:1-2:7, anticipation. And we'll think about that in one of our main ideas here of the seven ideas that we're going to look at. Anticipation. Boy, that's something that we're going to need to learn to appreciate and help the next generation to appreciate. Great things come to those who wait. And young person, if you are single, I put an exclamation point by the statement as it regards sexuality. Great things come to those who wait. Anticipation. 2:8-3:5. So anticipation and their first encounter is 1:1-2:7. 2:8-3:5. Couples longing for each other after a time of absence. Couples longing after a time of absence. And finally, 3:6 to about 5:1 or so, or just the end of chapter 4. Simply a reflection of the joy of physical union. It's just a love poem. The interaction of a husband and wife and the joy of physical union. So 1:1-2:7, anticipation, the first encounter. 2:8-3:5, the couple's longing for each other after a time of absence. 3:6-5:1, joy in physical union. One of the things that I've mentioned already that makes Song of Songs difficult to interpret is its literary identification. Is it just random reflections on love, poetic reflections on romantic love and marriage, or is there a sequence? Is it telling a sort of story that we can follow literarily? I've set out what I think is one way to look at it, though, again, there are many. I read several this week. This is just one I suggest. But one of the other difficulties of interpretation is the metaphorical language. And right away, you know, when you read this, and if you've read it already, you know what I'm getting at, but if you read it aloud, these metaphors, they seem to stand out even more, and they're probably going to make you laugh. You know, your neck is like a Pharaoh's horse or something. You know, not really. I mean, I don't suggest you write that in a card on your anniversary. It's just not going to. But in that culture, the things that Solomon writes about are things that are prized. One of the things you notice in Song of Songs is the metaphors are all about valuable things. They're esteemed things. They're things that are appreciated, but they're not just esteemed. They're also beneficial. They're practical. They're useful. They benefit you. Nature, agriculture. They're things that are valuable and that are beneficial. They're esteemed things. Duane Garrett, in his commentary on Song of Songs, helps us to understand the idea by saying this. A man from the southern United States might well compare his beloved's body to that of a magnolia blossom, or declare that his love for her is as enduring as the flow of the Mississippi. A man from the coast of Maine might experience something of the same feelings when he looks at waves breaking on the stony cliffs or smells the sea air as when he looks at his wife or smells her fragrance. That is to say, whatever is in one's culture that's valuable, but also practical, near, personally beneficial, those are the things that the author might write about. And that's the case here with Solomon. Well, let's talk about the way we can appreciate Song of Songs today. You'll read this week and think about literary structure, which I think will help you even just to appreciate the Song of Songs itself. But I want to set out for you seven ideas, seven ways that we can value sexuality within marriage just now. And if you have your bulletin there, hopefully some note space We're asking the question, how should Christians think about sexuality in a perverted culture? Song of Songs presents sex as the exalted physical celebration of husband and wife, sanctified by its timeliness and its exclusivity. I want to give seven ways, ideas that sort of unpack timeliness and exclusivity. If you've got a pen handy, keep Song of Songs open. We'll look at a few passages as a frame of reference, and you'll read more of them this week. Number one, this is the foundation. Sex happens in the context of a one-on-one heterosexual marriage. Sex in the context of one-on-one heterosexual marriage. That's the way Song of Songs presents it, and that's what we have here. It's one-on-one reserved for marriage and not outside of it. Let me just come back to this idea of our culture and where we're at and sort of try to set clear the ground a bit. I mentioned earlier, and you recognize this, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. In my experience Friday morning, perversion on AM radio, just new, local news radio, local television at night, this is what's being talked about. You live where I live, you hear the same kind of stuff. But we need to think about, these news reports are reporting about movies and magazines and all the rest. And what we need to recognize is that those movies and magazines, especially if you're a young person, think with me here. I want you to think about sex today. I want you to think clearly about it and biblically in a holy way. Those images that you see, now here's, I'm going to give you just groundbreaking, earth-shattering information. Are you ready for all these images? This is it. They are actors. They are actors. The people in the movies, those models, they are simply actors. That is not real sexuality. You understand that? What comes up on your screen and your homepage, whatever, they're actors. That's not real. That's as fictional as Space Invaders, as Superman, as Star Wars, as all the rest. That's not real. Those people are getting paid to do that. They're actors. Real sexuality that's valuable, that's enjoyable, that matters, happens in the context of heterosexual marriage between a husband and a wife, because God created it that way. It's not like the world has something that Christians don't have. In fact, Christians have it better there. It's one-on-one heterosexual marriage. Go with me in Song of Songs there, chapter 2 and verse 7. This is the conclusion of this first encounter, I think, and the anticipation and first encounter. And there's a phrase here that's noted in chapter 3 and verse 5 as well, and we'll note that in just a moment. Look at what's said here. Young people especially. 2:7, young women of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and the wild does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until the appropriate time. You live in a culture that does everything it can to get you to awaken love inappropriately. How rarely do we watch a movie and see any hints of the glory of God and sexuality in heterosexual marriage between one man and one woman for life? How rarely, and how often every other way? The text says, wait, be careful, not before it's time. Look at chapter 3 and verse 5. Young women of Jerusalem, it's a repeat. Do not stir up or awaken love until the appropriate time. And as you read these chapters, chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 3, you recognize that when the appropriate time comes, that's glorious. This is all the world would present and more. At the appropriate time, when love awakens in joy. This is some of Paul's logic, some in 1 Corinthians 7, though he says a lot more than I'm going to just say here in his argument, that sexuality is to be enjoyed by a husband and wife, and there's a structure for that, and outside of that, it's dangerous. But inside, it's privilege, it's honor. It has a context. Here's what I want to say with this and this first idea. Sexuality happens in a relationship if it happens well. We watch all these images, and it's like people, there's no relationship. It's just this event that happens, and they move on. Recognize, sexuality is so important. It's not just an objective thing. It's always subjective. It's not just some event that happens. It happens between two people, and it always has consequences. These are actors, and because they're actors, there's no consequence to what they do. I mean, that's part of what the movie is, the image. But in real life, there are always consequences to this activity because God's involved, and it happens in the context of a relationship. And in heterosexual marriage, as Song of Songs says, as the passages like Hebrews 13 say, that the marriage bed is to be undefiled, that God will judge the fornicator and the adulteress. Sexuality has a way of uniting husband and wife uniquely, such that no other part of their marriage has. Happens in a relationship. Number two, God is concerned about the body, and it's not wrong to talk about the human body in sexuality. God is concerned about the body, and it's not wrong to talk about it in husband and wife and in sexuality. That's a part of this. This is something, number two, what I'm stating here applies, parents, even to you, as we raise our children and help them to think. Our parents, as parents, let's make it our goal to be the primary sexual education teacher of our children. Not pornography, not the culture, not teachers, not friends, not anyone else. Let's do it. Let's be the people who teach our children and teach them about our bodies and the way God has designed them and how they should function. And this is what it looks like, and this is how marriage works. This is what God has for us. How many young adults would be so much further down the Lord had dad and mom been the primary sex ed teacher? But instead, mom and dad were too embarrassed to talk about the body, so they let pornography do it for them. Let movies be the educational outlet. Music. Oh, they'll learn about it. Too embarrassed. Really, it's laziness, and it's a lack of courage. It's a lack of love for God and our kids if we don't. It's not wrong to talk about the human body and desires and all the rest. But since we're talking about this, we need to say one other thing just about teaching our children. Point number two, God's concerned about the body, and so it's okay to talk about it. Parents, if we're going to talk to our kids about this issue, and I speak from some experience, I have one who's gone. If you don't take time to talk with them about lots of stuff, it's going to be extremely awkward to talk about this issue. That myth of quality time, it's a myth. It's going to take a lot of quantity time talking about a whole number of things, being life on life, trying to disciple our children day after day, week after week, year after year, if we're going to get a chance to get to their heart in talking to them about this issue. God is concerned about the body, and it's not wrong to talk about it. To talk about it with them, to set parameters, to be honest, to develop accountability, to teach them of the glory of waiting. I mentioned a moment ago chapter 2 and verse 7 and chapter 3 and verse 5 and God's concern about the body, but the necessity to talk about it in appropriate ways and appropriate times. One commentator writes, "This verse provides one of the most basic principles of a true love relationship. It speaks of genuineness and reality and right timing. It's sin which causes physical love to be expressed at the wrong time and in the wrong place with the wrong person. There's a time for everything in God. The way of our sinful world is to arouse and awaken love in false and evil ways. And parents, if we don't teach that to our children, someone else will, and it's an advertiser looking to use a body and an image to sell something, and our children are the fodder. Let it not be. God is concerned about the body. It's not wrong to talk about it, and we need to, with our spouse and with our children. Third, this means getting over inhibition. It means that we may have to speak in ways that we may think are uncomfortable to us. And we don't talk about this kind of stuff all the time. And that's rightly so, but we have to get over inhibition. That's some of the story, I think, of Song of Songs. I mentioned earlier this literary structure, and if you've got notes yet about that, 1:1 to 2:7 is sort of that anticipation and their first engagement. If you read through chapter 1:1 through about 1:7, you recognize that it's probably this woman speaking, and that's some of what is needing to happen. She's needing to get over inhibition about going to her husband and what that's like, and getting over the inhibition of being together, ultimately. Again, Duane Garrett writes, "The Jerusalem girls urge the woman to go out, to forget about her qualms and about picking at fleas among the shepherds, and simply go out and find her husband where he's to be found with the flocks. She must allow herself to get close to the man with all this involves. She must boldly claim the man she loves. She has to get over her inhibition." And this is some of what happens in marriage, and some of what we teach our children, but some of what biblical sexuality is. It's getting over inhibitions. It's letting go of that. It's transparency. That leads to number 4, communication. There is somewhat of a sequence in these 7. It begins in a relationship, one-on-one, heterosexual. God is concerned about the body. We communicate these things. Number 3, we have to get over inhibition then. And number 4, communication sort of summarizes these first 4 ideas. Communication. How many couples have divorced because communication about sexuality was a part of the breakdown of their marriage? Show me a couple who's communicating well in sexuality and likely you're going to have a healthy marriage. Because if there's communication there, there's likely communication about lots of other things in life. It's a part of what is important in a marriage, communication. Look at chapter 1 with me, Song of Songs there. Look at chapter 1. Look at just verses 15 and through 17. Verse 15 may be the husband talking, verse 16 and 17 may be the wife in response, but just look at the communication, the love and the transparency, the openness. "How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful your eyes are doves. How handsome you are, my love. How beautiful our bed is lush with foliage. The beams of our house are cedars. The rafters are cypress. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys." They are speaking to each other. This is romantic verbiage to each other. It's communication. It's transparency. It's openness. One of the things that you recognize when we think about sexuality and marriage and communication and openness, there's a unique way that this issue allows us to understand the gospel. In Genesis, in the garden account, when Adam and Eve are together and they are naked and unashamed, leads us to imply something. Obviously written after the fall. Nakedness often involves shame, right? I mean, uncovered somehow, you're ashamed. You want to cover yourself up. Cover me. In marriage, nakedness isn't rejected, it's embraced. Vulnerability is embraced. That is exactly what we do when we come to God. Vulnerable, seen, unclothed. God uses, and God accepts us in Christ. He forgives. He takes that. He knows the sin. We come sinful, dark, what would be shameful, and He, come, my child. You who are filthy, come put on white clothes. That's what marriage does. Where there would be shame, no, embrace. Come here. You're mine. Communication is a way of expressing that. It's acceptance. It's showing the gospel. It's vulnerability, not rejection, but acceptance. Happens in the context of a relationship. God is concerned about the body, which means we would need maybe to get over inhibitions, and we need to communicate as a part of that celebration of love. Number five, though all of this is such joy and celebration, number five, we need to make sure this stays private. If you're taking notes yet, number five, one of the principles you see in Song of Songs is the idea of privacy. That's what makes the marriage relationship special. It's private things that unite people. You may have a relationship in your workplace where you were on a leadership kind of team and there was a decision made and only the leaders knew about the decision and the effects. And within that circle of relationships, that information and the experience of making that decision binds leaders together. That's what unites them. We are together, and this information is exclusive to us. It's not for everyone else. And this is a part of what unites us. This is a part of what makes us a team. This is a part of what brings us together and moves us forward. That's biblical sexuality in marriage. It's private. It's not for everyone else. If we think we are in a digital age of exposure, I have a feeling we haven't seen anything yet. People writing about sexuality and experiences and images of it. Biblical sexuality is completely private. It makes the relationship special. Exclusivity solidifies the union. And it has always been this way for believers. Just recently, I was doing some reading in church history, and I don't do enough, and I need to do a lot more. But I was reading some, and one of the things that this historian recognized was that the early Christian literature, church fathers and so forth, before about 150 AD, they wrote a lot about just about doctrine. Just this is Christianity. They're just trying to get it communicated. After 150 AD, it seems like the foundation had been laid. Now they're trying to defend it. So you've got foundation and then defense of it. In one second century text, we don't know much about it. It's called the Letter to Diognetus. And this is it's in Greek, and we don't know who wrote it, don't know who Diognetus was. But one of the things, it's a great letter, just defending Christianity. One of the things that this author, again, we don't know who it is, Orthodox letter generally, but one of the things that this author said is this, I'm just quoting here, any Christian is free to share his neighbor's table, but never his marriage bed. And he was writing in the context of defending Christianity against charges of immorality. One of the things you notice continually about early Christianity is this desire for sharing and fellowship and helping one another as much as one can. And sexual integrity. Morality. Not like the pagans. Not like the world. It's private. Exclusive. This is just us and nobody else. Private. Number one, in the context of a relationship, because sexuality has consequences. What you see in the world is advertising. It's not real. It's not real. They're trying to sell you something. Don't be fodder for capitalism here. Don't be someone who goes to a used car lot and falls for the guy trying to sell you a Ferrari and inside is a Pinto engine. That's what you're doing if you're looking at pornography. That's what you're doing if your eyes are just on those magazine images, or that you're falling for something that's fake. It's not real. Sexuality happens in the context of a relationship, a committed marriage relationship, one-on-one for life. And God is concerned about our bodies. He made them this way. So we need to get over inhibition. We need to communicate. Number five, it needs to be private. And number six, it's okay to be passionate. You'll see this in reading Song of Songs. There's a good bit of passion here that husband and wife have for one another. The anticipation. The lack of distraction. There's complete devotion. There's holiness here. It's passion. Perhaps this is stated most clearly in Song of Songs in chapter 3. Just go over there with me, chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. It might be that this is a dream that the wife has, and she just read it with me, 3, 1 through 5. Look at passion here. Look at, in the context of a marriage relationship, look at passion. In my bed at night, I sought the one I love. I sought him, but did not find him. So what does she do? I will arise now and go about the city through the streets, the plazas. I will seek the one I love. I sought him, but I did not find him. It needs to be read dramatically. The guards who go about the city found me. Have you seen the one I love? I asked them. I had just passed them when I found the one I love. I held on to him and would not let go until I brought him to my mother's house, to the chamber of the one who conceived me. Young women of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and the wild does of the field. Do not stir up or awaken love until the appropriate time. But when it is appropriate, notice the passion that's there. She has a dream that he's gone, and she seeks throughout the city to find him. It's not just about an act. She's seeking him. She isn't just seeking pleasure. She isn't just seeking an act. She's seeking him. Passion for that person and no one else. Oh, the joy, husband and wife, of looking each other in the eye, as you'll read here in Song of Songs, visual, looking each other in the eye and saying, I'm yours. And I am not anyone else's. I am not available for anyone. I am not fodder for some advertiser using images to get my attention. I don't go there. I'm not theirs. I'm yours. And looking them in the eye and saying, you're mine. You do not belong to anyone else. Your body is not an object to be viewed by anyone else. You're mine. And friends, when you have that passion in your marriage, then you are coming close to the relationship between Christ and the church. Christ who says, church, you are mine. You do not belong to the devil. You are not the world. I died for you. I paid for your sins and not theirs. You are mine. The jealousy of Jesus Christ for the church expressed in biblical sexuality and marriage. You're mine and you're none other's. I love you, Christ says to the church, in a way I don't love the world. God loves the world. He died only for the church. You are mine. And the wife saying to the husband, I am yours and I am no one else's ever. And the church stands as a model for you, wife, as we say, Lord Jesus Christ, we are yours and we do not belong to the world. We do not belong to the devil. You alone are the Lord and we submit to you. You own us. It's exclusivity. It's passion. That's the gospel and that's Christian marriage. That's what makes it worth waiting for. That's what makes it so special. Degree of passion in Christian marriage. One writer says about chapter 3, 1 through 5, this looks like a dream or maybe a nightmare. In view of the opening statement, all night long on my bed, it's a kind of fear dream. She's so united to her husband that she cannot bear the thought of his not being there. This fear comes out in a dream. Four times in these opening verses, she describes her lover as the one my heart loves. She feels that she's lost part of herself, and in intensity of longing, she searches for him. She does all she can to find him, going to every part of the city, all its streets and squares, asking anyone she meets if they've seen him. Only intense love does that. It's passion. It's a reflection of Jesus Christ in the church. Number one, relationship. Two, God's concerned about the body, and we need to talk about our physical beings as an expression of the spiritual condition that we have. So three, we may need to get over inhibitions. We need to communicate. Four, it must be private. It's exclusive. That's the glory of Christianity. It's exclusivity, and it's passionate. Finally, number seven, if we're going to experience sexuality as it's described here, and what I think God intends, it may involve organizing life around our marriage, some planning, some organization. So often, families, even Christian families, we will organize our marriages, our family schedule around a number of activities. We have children, so they have activities. We have this activity, we have this activity, we have this activity. I've seen time and again over the years that busyness of life takes a toll on marriages. And it takes a toll on marriages and their experience of sexuality. And when they get busy and they don't have as much time for each other, it's then that temptation begins to come in. It's then that somehow images become more attractive because they're tired, haven't been together, all these other distractions going on. And so now there's this flirtation here, so much time at work, so much time at this activity, and soon things might begin to break down. You look at me and say, Pastor, that would never happen. You guard yourself today. I've seen it. I've seen it with my own eyes multiple times. The busyness of life distracts from marriage, and one of the symptoms is a lack of connection and sexuality. You might think, well, that's not such an important part of life. Well, it is. It is for both men and women. Guard. It may be the case that you need to let go of some things. You need to. We're not going to do as much of this or as much of that. Even in our own church, we try to scale back the schedule some so that you can have time together for all activities of life, including loving one another in this way. Organize your life schedule. Husband, turn off your cell phone at night. Can you shut your computer? Is cleaning the closets really that important after the kids are in bed tonight? Sexuality is not on par with just answering the phone for a customer. They can wait. It's not on par with making sure that the dust cobwebs are out of the ceiling. It can wait. Your spouse is more important than that. Because if you're married, there are 6 billion people on the planet who cannot do for your spouse what only you can do. You might look at that and say, you're thinking this in terms of responsibility. No, that's privilege, isn't it? It's a privilege that I am the only person my wife has. If I view her well, that's a privilege, isn't it? That's not like it's a responsibility. There's 6 billion other humans. That's a privilege. Let me run through these again. A relationship, God's concerned about the body, get over inhibitions, communication, privacy, passion, and maybe planning. I think this is some of how Christians should think about sexuality in a perverted culture. Well, I've encouraged you to read this week. And it may be the case that it would be helpful to pray as well. Maybe we should just add an eighth. Pray for one another. Pray about your marriage. Pray about your intimacy. Pray that God would keep you together and that this would be a part of that union.